Last year, Illinois spent less than $300 on books in prisons for the entire state. And as Julius Mercer says, even when there are books available, they're not always that helpful.
A lot of the books are antiquated because it's the least of their priority. So they provide just enough to meet the standard and not go over their budget. But the lack of education opportunity for a lot of inmates will keep them screwed.
Plus, getting medical treatment when English isn't your first language can be daunting. Later this hour, how companies are bringing translators directly to patients. And Chicago's police department keeps a database of gang members, but reporting by ProPublica Illinois shows that much of that data is inaccurate. Here's Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson on WTTW.
I think that it's important for us to know who the people are in this city, as well as in this state, are committing crimes and are affiliated with gangs, but I also think we have a responsibility to get it right.
It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In Illinois, nearly half of all people who are incarcerated behind bars are back there again within 3 years. There's a number of solutions that researchers agree on how to prevent those rates of recidivism. One of them is pretty simple: having better access to education in prisons. And of course, a key part of education is books. But when Lee Gaines started investigating this issue for the Illinois Newsroom, she found that the state's Department of Corrections spent less than $300. That's the amount for the entire fiscal year of 2017 on books throughout all Illinois prisons. The number used to be much higher. IDOC data shows they spent roughly $786,000 in 2002. Again, that's compared to less than $300 last year. Lee's been working on this as an education reporter for the Illinois Newsroom. Her story came out just last week, and she's here with us to talk about it. Hi, Lee. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
And you brought along two guests with you. Megan Maurer is on the line with us. She's currently assistant director of the Scenic Regional Library in Union, Missouri, but she used to work as a librarian at the Robinson Correctional Institute in southeastern Illinois up until last year. Megan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line with us from Chicago is Julius Mercer. He's a writer and public speaker who was previously incarcerated and also spoke to Lee for the story. Julius, we appreciate you being here as well. Good morning.
Yes, hello. Good morning, Nyla and Lee. And hello, Megan.
So you guys know each other, right?
Megan is great. Megan, when I was incarcerated, she was a joy to work with, and she was an inspiration, and she knows that I just totally respect her because she was very positive, and she was like different. She wanted to see everyone get out and stay out or change their lives and, you know, recapture their dreams and goals. Very inspirational.
And apart from being inspirational, Julius, what role did books play and the prison library play in your incarceration? What kind of books were you hoping to read when you first went to a prison library?
Well, first of all, I want to tell you this. I can't believe, you know, when you got Megan on the phone, I started getting emotional. I was like, oh, no. Well, I speak a lot. I talk a lot. But, you know, I usually get emotional when I speak in various aspects of my life, and it's changing. But, you know, this is a great opportunity to connect and talk about something that's important. And last time I spoke to Megan was probably about a year ago. So I just wanted to tell you again, this brings so much joy to my heart. In terms of books, you know, Megan knows I had, when I was locked up there, I had about, when I met her at Robinson, Illinois Correctional Center, I had about a year and a half to do before I was released. So I had some personal goals that, along with my life changing, a project for a speaking engagement. I had wrote a book, and I needed a positive direction to get that thing going. And Megan knew in my free time I was working on it. So in my free time there, I would look up books that had to do with like Think and Grow Rich, business books, how to develop a plan, different power words to use, like when I do advertising and marketing for my project when I get out. And so sometimes Megan would have an idea, or she'd come across some books, or I would have some free time and I would look and try to find those books. But they were all pertinent to me gaining a new perspective you know, changing my life, given my criminal background. I had to have something that could offset my criminal background and that can catapult me to be successful regardless of my criminal background. It's like reinventing myself.
Yeah, Julius, thanks for sharing that, and we're happy to reunite you with Megan on the air here. Julius, did you find those books in the prison library that you were looking for?
Yes, I did. And I don't know if Megan remembers, but because we talked quite a bit. But a lot of the materials were, like, I'm going to use the word antiquated, you know, old. But the good thing was is some of the business ideals, or I also used to read a lot of magazines that had magazines that might have, like, groups or things that was going on that connected to my ideal, who I can connect with, that my ideal to help change a life, what was going out there. So I would get magazines that had different articles about different groups in different parts of the United States. So I would cut them out or save them, or I would take notes so I can connect with. And so Megan, she knew that I'm going to tell you this. This is what I knew about her. She always wished there was more. There was more, and there was more updated material. And I remember many times it was, like, frustrating because of the correctional center. I don't know if it's directly the correctional center itself, but the lack of money to help purchase new things. And she would – I remember that she would, like, receive donations or books that were donated. She would go out of her way. She wasn't paid to do this. She would bring them in from outside resources, bring them in. So yeah, that was a problem because when you're incarcerated, I was gone for 4 straight years, 3 years prior to meeting her. Time passes by, and all the new things that's happening, including technology, those things that just keep going, and we miss that. We miss that. We don't catch it, or we don't have access to it. And so, yeah.
So, Megan, I wonder if – thanks for that, Julius. Megan, I wonder if you can weigh in here. Is that the case? Can you give us a sense of what at least the prison library at Robinson Correctional Center was like when you worked on it?
Sure, yeah. So when I started at the Robinson Correctional Center, we had a general library and we have a law library. So just so that everyone knows, a law library is a right of anyone that's incarcerated, and a general library, think of that more like a school library or a public library, and that's a privilege. So it can be taken away from offenders if there's behavioral issues or anything else going on. So when I came into the library, I actually was really lucky. I had inherited a library that was in really good shape. They had an automation system, so there was a way to check out the books, because a lot of times it was just simply stamping cards, but they had an automation system so we could actually look up and see if we had a book, if someone came in and asked for one. But at that point I was told, hey, we don't have a budget for this, so to fund the general library. So anything that you want for the general library, you're going to have to get through donations. And I was really lucky that I worked with an administration who was supportive of working with external groups to bring in materials. That's not always the case, but I was very lucky that I had that experience in Robinson. So I worked with a group called Reading Reduces Recidivism, or 3Rs for short. And once or twice a year, I would go up to Central Illinois and I would shop their donations. So they would be in contact with me and I would send them a list of things I was specifically looking for. And if they could get it for me, they would through their means, where they would be shopping at book sales, or they had a teeny tiny little budget. And if there was something specifically I was looking for, they would try to buy it for me if they could and then donate it to me. So I would go and shop their collection of books and bring back what I wanted for the library. And then also offenders would donate materials to me as well. So if they got it sent in from their family or something like that, and they read it once and they didn't want it because they have a limited amount of things that they can store in their housing unit, then they would donate it to the library.
That's Megan Maurer. She's a former librarian at the Robinson Correctional Center in southeastern Illinois. On the line from Chicago, Julius Mercer has been sharing his experience using the library and being with Megan when he was incarcerated at Robinson Correctional Center. In studio with me here in Urbana is Lee Gaines, who's an education reporter for the Illinois Newsroom, who first reported on this issue. Lee, so your data showed you found out information, basically, that the state's Department of Corrections spent less than $300. Is that correct?
Correct.
For the entire fiscal year of 2017.
Correct.
On all the libraries that mm-hmm. exist?
There's about 28 correctional facilities.
And so we did reach out to the Department of Corrections to explain the drop in funding. As I mentioned, at one point in 2002, the budget showed, Lee, was it $786,000?
Yes. Yep.
And so we did ask them to explain why there was a huge drop in funding, and they did, right before the show, respond with a comment that did not provide an explanation for the funding drop, but they said they spent $2 million during the last fiscal year to update their facility law libraries. They also said they have converted to a lot of electronic curriculum and testing for GED programs. But Megan, to your point, that's a different library system, the law libraries, than these libraries you're talking about, correct?
Right, yeah. So the law library, and I don't doubt that they spent that much money, because if you, you know, anyone can look around and see how expensive law books are, and those need to be constantly updated with the changing statutes and that kind of thing that would affect anyone who's incarcerated. So I don't doubt for a moment that they spent that much money. But again, I just want to reiterate that law libraries are a right that is provided to the offenders who are incarcerated, and the general library is something that is generally totally completely separate from the law library. They may be in the same room. Like in Robinson, they were basically in the same room, but the law library was divided into a different section. But they're still separate things.
And what does the general library that you maintain, Megan, I wonder, Julius shared, we have so emotional for him to even talk to you. So I think that gives us a sense of what role you played in his life. What role does that general library play in the lives of people who are incarcerated at when you were working with them at Robinson?
Well, I like to think that the general library was a lifeline to a lot of offenders, and that they had the opportunity to come in and find something that they could escape into, just like anyone who would come into a public library looking for a book to escape in. It's really no different. The type of materials that they wanted are generally not any different than someone's asking for in a public library. They want stuff that's new, popular, best-selling fiction, and they want resources on the nonfiction side. They're looking for information on healthcare and if they have diseases or anything like that, that they're wanting more information on how to treat those, understand those, that kind of thing. And also, like in Mr. Mercer's case, where he was looking for materials on how to run a business when he gets outside, how to market himself, all of those things. Because as we know, everything changes so rapidly, how people access information. So they could be incarcerated for, you know, 5 to 7 years. And when they went in, they didn't even really text anyone. And then as they're leaving, you know, we've got smartphones that have access to the internet and all sorts of things that we take for granted that someone has never really had exposure to before. And so trying to understand how to thrive in that environment and how to be successful, because that's really, for the most part, that's what they're wanting to be, is they don't want to come back to prison. They don't want to be reincarcerated. They want to be successful, and they're trying to look for any way to do that.
Julius, was that the case for you? Was the library your lifeline when you were incarcerated?
Yes, it was. Actually, I was very fortunate. Megan had hired me to be a law clerk. I had no experience, but however, she trained me and had trainers to come in from outside of the correctional centers. This one gentleman I know in particular, he would go to different prisons and he would train the law clerks.
and his job would be to train me on how to direct an inmate in the law library section of it, okay, to direct them to find what they need, just direct them to find what they need, whatever they're looking for. But in terms of the library, like Megan mentioned, it's two separate. In terms of the library itself, yes, even on days that I didn't work, I would always hope that I can get there, you know, sometimes 2, 3, or 4 days a week. But you can't because there's a limited amount of time throughout the day. There was probably about 1,200 to 1,400 inmates. And then you have to fill out like a pass to go there. And then you have to wait till Megan goes through the passes. And then she has to make sure that it's fair that everyone comes, has an opportunity to come. Some people try to come in more than the others. So it's like,
Julius, you wanted to get there as much as you could. And Megan, I imagine that was also the case. I imagine we're just about to take a break, but Megan, it sounds like there are lots of folks who wanted to use the library. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We always had people wanting to use the law library and the general library. Sometimes there's a certain number of people and we'd had to turn them away because we were full.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with a former Robinson Correctional Center librarian, Megan Maurer, Julius Mercer, and Lee Gaines. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about prison libraries with reporting from the Illinois Newsroom and Lee Gaines. Education reporter Lee is in studio with me here in Urbana. We're talking about her reporting she did looking at how much the state of Illinois and the Department of Corrections spends on libraries. That's general libraries in prison, not law libraries, as we've been learning from Megan Maurer, who's the former librarian at Robinson Correctional Center in southeastern Illinois. She's on the line with us along with Julius Mercer, who was formerly incarcerated at Robinson Correctional Center. Twitter comment we just got. You can always tweet to 21STShow. Matthew just said, come on, are you serious? Illinois prisoners' access to books is being restricted. Did someone read Malcolm X's autobiography as a cautionary tale? This is as absurd as it is inhumane. Thanks for that comment, Matthew. Any questions or comments, as always, tweet to us at 21STShow. Lee, let me just ask you about this funding. So they spent $300. Illinois Department of Correction data shows that they spent less than $300.
Yes.
On books for general libraries and in across 28 prisons, 28 mm-hmm. libraries.
Yes.
Okay. And who's responsible for the funding levels for prison libraries? Who decides that?
Okay, so that's state lawmakers' job, really. The Department of Corrections can propose a budget to the governor's office. They can also propose a budget to the General Assembly. So they can make a pitch for how much money they think they need. But at the end of the day, it's the state lawmakers who decide what they get.
And so is it because of the budget crisis that so little is being spent on libraries?
I don't believe so. My colleagues down at NPR Illinois, they did a story about the budget crisis impacts on the facilities. Apparently, IDOC is struggling to keep its facilities running right now, and that can be laid at the feet of the budget crisis. But the spending, as the data that I obtained shows, spending drop-offs on general prison libraries began well before that. They began around 2005. They started dropping off pretty precipitously. And so that's way before the budget crisis began. So I don't think we can explain this away or or blame the budget crisis for this drop off in funding. The timeline just doesn't match up.
And just a note to our audience, we did reach out to IDOC to ask them for an explanation for this drop of funding. They responded with an answer about how much they'd spent on their law libraries. Lee, you also reached out to IDOC to get an explanation.
I did, and they did not provide an explanation. What they did say was that there is no specific appropriation for reading material for the general library.
And I think when we think about the budget crisis, Megan, I wanted to ask you about this. We just did a story yesterday. We were speaking to State Senator Andy Menar about the fact that the state of Illinois owes corrections workers $40 million in back pay. And I wonder if the state can't get its act together to pay salaries, I can see people saying, how big of a priority are books for prisoners? Megan, what would you say in response to that?
When I spoke to Lee a few months ago, I said that, you can look at the statistics and see how the incarceration levels in Illinois across the United States are rising. So you get more people, the costs go up, and you're looking for any way that you can possibly cut costs because you have to do other things. You have to provide them shelter. You have to provide them clothes. You have to provide them food. And you don't have to provide them books to read. And so they look for, I think the phrase I used with Lee was low-hanging fruit. And sometimes, oftentimes, libraries become the low-hanging fruit. So, but I don't think it's too late. I think that we can turn around, and I think that they can put books back into prisons or support that more financially. And keep moving forward and align with our goals of educating offenders and preparing them to leave a facility and to not come back. It's never too late.
Lee, what does the research show about education and investment in incarcerated individuals in terms of, as we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, obviously no one wants to have repeat offenders, repeat incarceration, recidivism.
Right. So the research actually pretty clearly shows that access to educational opportunities within the context of prison reduces recidivism rates. There's less research about books specifically, but I talked to a researcher. Her name is Lois Davis. She's from the RAND Corporation. And basically what she said is that prison libraries are a really integral component of that work because books are often the building blocks of any educational program. And one of the other groups that I interviewed for the story is Chicago Books to Women in Prison. And they told me that one of the books that they prioritize for inmates that they donate books directly to is GED books, because there might be a GED program within a prison, but then they don't have a book to take back to their cell and study with. And I think the phrase that Vicky White, the president of Chicago Books to Women in Prison, used was, why set them up for failure?
How did you decide to do this story originally?
So part of it was inspiration from the 21st. I was listening to a segment. I work in the newsroom next door. And there was Jenny Volan from the John Howard Association was talking about a lack of funding for prison.
Oh, because we were talking about prisons banning books.
Yes, you were talking about banning books. And I started thinking about sort of the larger picture of this, or what do prison libraries look like? And I started talking to groups like Chicago Books to Women in Prison and also local groups, including Reading Reduces Recidivism. And what I learned was essentially that the reason that these groups exist is because of the lack of funding. And I decided to FOIA IDOC, and now we know that they spent less than $300 on books in prisons last year. And I do want to note that those are textbooks. That wasn't money going to general prison libraries. That was textbooks for educational programs.
Mm-hmm. And how are other states doing? Do other states fund their prison libraries?
So I ended up talking to a woman from Colorado. She's been a prison librarian in both Florida and Colorado. And she told me, she didn't have any data to give me, but she told me that it's really, Illinois is not unique in that it does not fund its general prison libraries, but there are states that do. Colorado is one of them. So Colorado actually jointly funds its prison libraries with its Department of Corrections and Department of Education. And so I actually, when I reached out to IDOC, I asked them specifically, like, is this something that could work in Illinois? And unfortunately, they did not respond to me.
So Lee, as you've done all of this reporting, we will tweet out those links, by the way. If you follow 21ST Show, they'll also be at our website, 21stshow.org. all the reporting you've done on this, if people want to look into this issue a little further, what's the biggest question you still have about this?
So I really struggled with accountability with this story because, like I said, IDOC proposes its budget, but at the end of the day, they don't set their own budget. That's up to lawmakers to do. So I wonder, is spending on books in prison, is education in prison a priority for state lawmakers? Is it a priority for Governor Rauner? Is it a priority for J.B. Pritzker? And I don't have the answer to those questions.
All right. I know you will continue to ask them. That's Lee Gaines. She's an education reporter with the Illinois Newsroom. I want to thank Megan Maurer for being with us and Julius Mercer as well. All of you, thank you so much for taking the time.
Hey, Nyla. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Julius. Did you want to add something?
Do you have 30 seconds?
Go for it.
Yeah, I want to tell you this to advocate what Lee is saying and Megan is saying. Look, I graduated from Kansas State University with a bachelor's. And I was an All-American and Olympic hopeful in track and field. I was world-class ranked, okay? And so, but when I got to Robinson, I'm going to tell you, so I had a lot of other issues, untreated bipolar, affective disorder, which had me homicidal and suicidal, in and out of hospitals with suicide attempts. I was homeless, in addition, that led to a substance abuse. And so I struggled for many years in and out being incarcerated. And a lot of people thought, oh, he's just a drug head. He's got issues. Well, while I was at Robinson, I also read a lot of books related to health, and I wanted to understand what was going on with me. In addition, I ended up getting certified in the CAPS, Associate in Addictions, and all that knowledge helped me to understand what was going on with me, and I accepted what was going on with me, and that gave me this fire to take care of my life when I got out of prison, not only while I was there, but also when I got out, I got connected with mental health. Because there's a relationship between that and substance abuse. And I found out that through those books and readings, which Megan knows this whole story, okay, that I wanted to know, why am I there with a college degree, never been involved with the gang, but why am I there constantly with everyone else who dropped out of school at an early age, had a lot of issues? Well, I found out in the book that I wrote, one of my chapters is titled They're Just Like Me, that I had emotional interferences and issues that caused some psychosomatic issues.
Yeah, so Julius, it sounds like education was a huge, huge part of your recovery. Thank you very much for sharing that. I appreciate you sharing your story and what you learned from Megan and other folks. Thank you for that. That's Julius Mercer. Thanks. I appreciate it. When you're in the hospital in need of medical care, you just want to feel better. The last thing you want to think about is if you'll be understood or not. But for millions of people in Illinois, that's often the reality. In the Chicagoland area alone, there were more than 1 million people who were considered limited English proficient in 2011. Last week, we were talking about a new initiative by immigration advocates to make hospitals more welcoming to immigrants. Today, we're talking about some new technology that can help with that language barrier. There's a technology called video remote interpreting, or VRI, that's bringing interpreters directly to patients through video. Medical interpreters are trained in more than 200 languages, including American Sign Language, and they video conference into patients watching on iPads. Joining me now to tell us a little bit more about this technology is Rosalinda Justiana. She's a patient advocate and language service coordinator for the Rush Copley Medical Center in Aurora. Also joining us on the line from Lombard, Illinois, is Jeannie Roskamp, a trilingual interpreter for a VRI company called In-Demand Interpreting. Rosalinda, Jeannie, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you for having me here.
Rosalinda, let's start with you. Can you tell me a little bit more about how this technology works?
Absolutely. So when a patient presents, let's say, for example, for the first encounter in the emergency department, they can identify, we identify the language need, and we do have a video remote interpreter available. And basically, it is like an iPad, but a little bit larger. And the languages are available. They select via touchscreen, and immediately within seconds, we have a medical interpreter available. So this allows for the triage process. This can then also be taken in the patient room, and it allows the physician to readily communicate with the patient.
How often are these translators used?
We use them every day. We have Spanish language interpreters available in-house, but we have many other different language needs in the Aurora community, so we use a video remote interpreter every day.
And Jeannie, you actually speak both Spanish and Korean in addition to English. How long have you been a translator?
Well, I started my interpreting career since I was 7 years old, when I had to begin interpreting for my parents when my family had to move from Korea to Argentina. So just to provide a background to our audience, in the lingual world, we refer as translation the written rendition of a source language into the target language. We call interpretation as the oral rendition of a spoken original or sign language for the deaf patient into the target language. So the two are different, and I won't go into details about that, but that's something that we want to keep in mind.
Thank you for that. So it's interpretation is the correct, is the word that we should be using. And are you doing interpretation, Jeannie?
Yes.
Are you speaking with people, so you're based in Lombard, are you speaking with people across Illinois or across the country when you're doing your interpretation?
Across the country, including Illinois.
Rosalinda, I wanted to ask you about this whole issue of language access. I thought about this a lot last year when I was going through my breast cancer treatment, because frankly, it was hard enough for me to communicate with my doctors when communication is my job and English is my native language. Do you find it hard for patients to say that they need help to communicate? How important is this?
Well, it's critically important, and it's interesting as I'm listening to Jeannie's story, it's not unfamiliar. Many patients, you know, are used to the old way that they felt that they had to bring a family member or a support person to help interpret their encounter. But patients make it very clear from the, you know, from the onset that they're going to need a language assistant. And so the VRI really provides an autonomy that they never had before, because they're not dependent on a family member to be in the room. They're allowed a little bit more privacy. And many times patients don't want their family members involved in the decision, or they want to be the ones to share the information and then ask for help. And so, you know, they're able to maintain that, like I said, that autonomy and that privacy, and then they're able to understand not necessarily the medical jargon, but the interpreter is trained in helping the patient decipher the questions being asked of them.
And Jeannie, I know that UI Health in Chicago, we're talking to Rush Copley Medical Center in Aurora, OSF Healthcare in Peoria, have all implemented this technology. Those are pretty urban locations. Do you also work with hospitals in more rural settings, Jeannie?
Oh, yes, absolutely. At least I had the opportunity to interpret for very small clinics in some rural area in California or Washington. Also, yes, definitely we do reach that far.
Rosalinda, are there any drawbacks to using this as a virtual company, or are you finding that this is just filling a demand that otherwise wouldn't have been met?
This is absolutely filling a demand. For example, for Aurora, we have 25% of our patients have a Spanish language need, and so we're not able to fill that with our on-site interpreters alone. So we rely on the VRI as a support resource for patients, because we have them in our outpatient clinics. We have them in our freestanding emergency center. So they are really in a lot of remote locations, even within the medical center. So it has not been nothing but an asset and resource for us.
How long have you been using it, Rosalinda?
So we've used video remote interpreting for at least 10 years, but the provider that we use now we've had for 2 years, and the technology is just impressive. And when I introduce it to a patient and they feel like there is that added person in the room with them, they really do provide a lot of positive feedback for us.
Well, thanks for letting us learn a little bit more about how this is working with VRI in hospitals. Rosalinda Giustiano is a patient advocate and the language services coordinator at Rush Copley Medical Center in Aurora. Jeannie Roskamp on the line from Lomberg, where she's a certified video remote interpreter with a company called In Demand Interpreting. Ladies, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about problems with Chicago's gang database and how accurate that information is with ProPublica Illinois' Mick Dumke. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You often hear from Chicago police, especially when there's a shooting, how much of it is, quote, gang-related. Certainly, especially recently, there have been a lot of questions raised about how the police are keeping track of gangs, especially who's in them. Obviously, that data is important on many levels, not the least of which is preventing crime from happening. But a new investigation from ProPublica Illinois shows that the Chicago Police Gang Database, which contains information on 128,000 people and counting, is outdated and plagued with inaccuracies. ProPublica Illinois reporter Mick Dumke has been reporting out this topic. He's on the line with me now to tell us more about this. Hey, Mick, welcome back to The 21st.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Mick, what kind of things did you find out were wrong with this database? Can you give us some examples?
Well, there is some information that just sticks out as unbelievable. I'll put it that way. And at the top of the list is, in this database, there are dozens of people who appear to be elderly. There are more than 160 people in the database who are in their 70s or 80s, according to the ages in there. And even more striking than that, there are 13 people who are listed as 118 years old, and two people who are listed as 132 years old. So I would say those are entries that probably shouldn't be in there. Either they are outright errors, which is my assumption, or they haven't been updated in some way. I haven't heard about a 132-year-old living in Chicago, let alone someone who is affiliated with a gang and in need of being monitored by police, let alone there being two of them. So that's the kind of thing, just combing through this data, that you look at and you say, that is curious to the point of being incredible.
And so, Mick, I wonder if we can take a step back. We say gang database. Is this a list? What is this, and how do you end up on it?
Well, it's actually part of a huge data warehouse. That's the way the police department describes it, a data warehouse where they collect and maintain vast amounts of data about people who are in the criminal justice system in one way or another. I think the biggest block is probably, or the best known block, is people who are arrested. Of course, they're going to maintain some data. They're going to maintain records of everyone that the police department arrests. But there are also thousands of people in this system who have never been arrested. They've never been charged with a crime. They have been stopped by police, and during the investigatory stop process, which your listeners might know more as it's more common, how it's more commonly referred to as stop and frisk. When police stop someone, they often, you know, get their name, they get a lot of information about them. One thing they also record is their supposed gang affiliation. So they keep all that data and they put that in the database.
And then
so
what is
I'm
this?
Referring to,
oh, mm-hmm,
yeah,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and then what is this database used for then?
Well, real quickly, I think what we refer to as the gang database is just a portion of this bigger, huge data warehouse. It's the portion of that data that includes information police have recorded about someone's alleged gang affiliation. So that's what they refer to as the gang database. It's just a portion of a bigger set of data. It's used for a number of things. Kind of notoriously around the Chicago area, it is accessed by, or has been accessed by, federal immigration officials who have used it in gang enforcement, targeting people who are undocumented, they believe are gang members, and targeting them and ending up, in some cases, detaining people and moving to deport them. This happened in at least two instances last year where men said the information about them was false and turned around and sued the Chicago Police Department over the information, because now they're tied up in the immigration system as a result. It's also used in some court proceedings. If someone is charged with a crime, during the bond court process, when a judge determines whether they can post bail and go free or whether they have to sit in jail until they go to trial, oftentimes this information could be brought up. It's accessible, I should say, Nyla, to dozens of other law enforcement agencies, other police departments, some federal agencies, county, state agencies. So we actually don't know all the uses of it, because there are so many different players who could have an opportunity to get into it.
Mick, I want to go back to what you said about immigration, because I think we hear all the time about immigrants being deported because they committed crimes. But I just want to ask you about something you said. So is there a possibility that someone could be deported because they ended up on this list and they didn't commit a crime? They were just maybe stopped by police?
Well, that's what happened, according to two men who have filed suit against the Chicago Police Department. These are two separate cases of Chicago men from the southwest side of the city who claim that they were erroneously entered into the gang database based on police stops. What I was saying earlier, they were stopped or in some way interviewed by police, and the police put them down as gang members. These men say that's because of just their ages, their ethnic background, racial background, being Hispanic men, and because of the neighborhoods they lived in, which are known to have some gang activity. And so they're saying that the police, as a result of those factors, concluded that they were gang members and wrote them down in the database as such. And that subsequently, the federal ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, accessed this information, and during its gang enforcement, some of its gang enforcement sweeps, they swept up these men, and now they're facing deportation. And in at least one of the instances, the police department has admitted they made a mistake, and the individual shouldn't have been in there. And it's worth noting he was actually in there twice, according to his attorney, as being a member of two different gangs. So they're saying it was just full of mistakes in these instances.
And how hard is it, you mentioned lawsuits, to get your name taken off of this list or this database?
Well, what I was told is that nobody ever gets taken off it. I mean, the thinking from the police department is, if you're in there, let's say you're arrested, the only way you would get removed from the database is if your record was formally expunged through a process in the criminal court system. And even then, your arrest itself, or if there's an investigatory stop, you still might be in there because the standard is different for, you know, why you're recorded. So I think the bottom line, to answer your question directly, Nyla, is it's incredibly difficult, or has been incredibly difficult, to get your information changed or removed at all. Now, once I started reporting on this in response to questions, the police department came back to me and said they're going to change things, that they are drafting internal rules that would basically create a process for people to be able to update the information or to object to it and potentially get the information removed from the system. And that's a whole new thing. So that's what they're promising right now, and I guess it's up to us to hold them to that promise.
I'm speaking with ProPublica Illinois reporter Mick Dumke about his reporting about Chicago Police Department's gang database. We'll tweet out all the links to Mick's reporting. You can even, Mick's got a way for you to look and see if your name is even on there if you follow 21ST Show. Mick, to that point, Chicago Superintendent Eddie Johnson, as you said, he's been acknowledging problems with this. I just wanted to hear a little bit of him talking about this issue.
We recognize that some people may be misidentified at certain points, and we are looking at processes in terms of being able to give them what they need in terms of taking them out of that that particular territory. So I think that it's important for us to know who the people are in this city, as well as in this state, are committing crimes and are affiliated with gangs, but I also think we have a responsibility to get it right.
Mick, to his point, it sounds like there are people from outside the Chicago region who may be on this in this database as well. Are there?
Well, if they were arrested or stopped in Chicago, they definitely could be. I mean, this particular set of data is maintained by the Chicago Police Department. So I don't know how or why, what circumstances would take a police officer who's working for the city of Chicago to some other municipality to make an arrest and then record in the system. I'm not saying it couldn't ever happen, but I think that's probably remote. So these are mostly individuals who have in some way, shape, or form been stopped or arrested in the city and then entered in here. But it is worth noting that, as I mentioned, other agencies can access Chicago's data. And at the same time, Chicago can access data from agencies outside the city. So for instance, police officers in Chicago and in other areas can get information from the Illinois Department of Corrections. They maintain their own data about people who have gone into the system there, and that includes gang affiliation data. The Department of Corrections is very meticulous, I'm told, about collecting information about gang affiliation because it affects the way they house inmates. They don't want people who are leaders of rival gangs to necessarily be housed together, for instance. So they collect this information and use it in a practical manner, and police officers in Chicago and elsewhere can access that data.
And what do you, when you talk to different police officers, do you get a sense of acknowledgement among police officers or other detectives or people in the force that sometimes this data is problematic?
I do. I actually have heard some things fairly similar to what Superintendent Johnson was saying there a moment ago from officers who use this information on a regular basis. They acknowledge that there are mistakes and errors in the data. And, you know, one officer, for instance, I spoke with who does a fair amount of work with gangs on the street, he said anytime he is accessing this information, he goes and double checks it. If it's something he's going to use in an investigation process or just doing background on individuals, he'll look up their information in the data, and then he'll go back to like original police reports or other documentation to try to get the origin of the gang affiliation data, just because he feels like that's the best way for him to get quality information. But he does use the database as a tool as well. So I think most of the officers I spoke with, they absolutely want it to be reliable, but they also share the superintendent's view that this isn't something that should be taken away from them. This is very important, they feel, to be able to monitor people who encounter the police.
And Mick, I just wanted to ask you about that as we end here, just about, as you've reported on crime, you've reported on gangs in Chicago and problems with violence for a long time. And also, you're very familiar with Mayor Emanuel's quest for data and how important that is, and data and policing. What does this all make you think about all of that?
Well, that's a great question, Nyla, because I think that's one of the interests I have. Certainly, I am concerned and interested in the very specifics of this data set and how it's used and the civil rights and civil liberties questions that are raised by it. But more broadly, I think the point you're raising here is that we live in an era of massive data collection about all of us. I mean, we've all heard the conversations going on about Facebook and how our data on Facebook and other social media is scraped and used by various players. And so I think when it's a public agency, a law enforcement agency collecting data, particularly data that is about people and about behaviors that are not have not been proven to be criminal. I mean, this is not conviction data in a lot of instances. Like I said, there are people in this database who've been added, thousands of people added to the database the last few years based just on being stopped by police. I think there are so many questions about that. If it's people who are purported to be gang members,
is that even legal?
Like,
yeah, if you've stopped someone and you don't charge them with a crime, is it legal to put their name in a database and then say that they're a gang member, perhaps?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question because, you know, the ACLU here has some sort of legal, I think it might be a formal consent decree, but it's certainly an agreement with the Chicago Police Department to improve their data collection of people they stopped. I mean, for a while, the police department, you know, they were stopping tens of thousands of people a year with very minimal documentation. So there's actually more documentation than there used to be. And the idea is that with the additional documentation, there's more accountability, but there's also more data collection. There's just data everywhere. So I guess my broader point is, you know, you're not in a gang, you don't think you're living in an area where you're ever going to be accused of being a gang. Well, I still think this is a civil rights question that you should be wrestling with about where the lines are drawn, because as has been shown, someone can get entered into a law enforcement database and then some sort of enforcement action can be taken against them because of that information, which may or may not be true. I mean, that's really the issue here. And that's one that I think we have to really wrestle with, where are the lines drawn? Where should they be drawn?
That's ProPublica Illinois' Mick Dumke, his reporting on this gang database. Thanks for being with us, Mick. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Nyla. I appreciate it.
All of the information about this program is at our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got all the information about our guests today if you want to read more about Mick's reporting. That does it for us today, though. I'm afraid we're out of time. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.